Chapter 26. Grooming a Killer. If there was no respite during the night, the days were far worse. Gacy was pushing me for more and more attention, making more bizarre demands. Ramirez, as well, was hungry to meet me and kept asking for my phone number. I was able to put him off by telling him I didn't have a phone. Meanwhile, my family and friends noticed the strain I was under. At times, I appeared vacant and distracted. More disturbing were my overreactions to things that seemed quite ordinary to others. One evening, I was sitting in a movie theater with Jared, waiting for the film to begin. It's common in Las Vegas theaters to scan the audience, since there are frequent sightings of our more famous citizens, such as Andre Agassi, Mike Tyson, or Wayne Newton. As I was making my usual survey, I noticed one strange-looking man sitting by himself. He caught my attention because there was a black bag placed protectively between his legs under the seat. I also noticed that he was looking carefully around the theater, which seemed suspicious to me, even though I was doing the same thing. "Jared," I whispered, "look at that guy over there." I nodded my head in the man's direction. My brother briefly glanced over his shoulder, then resumed eating his popcorn. "Jared," I said more urgently, "look. He's checking everyone out who walks into the theater."
"So what?"
he mumbled with his mouth full, rooting around in the box for another handful of popcorn. "What's the big deal?" "Look at the bag he's got on the floor. I swear, there's something real weird about him. I bet he's got a gun in that bag. Maybe more than one. What if he plans on opening fire on everyone in the theater?" My brother just shook his head with disgust. "Jason, just chill out. Come on, the movie's about to start." "Listen to me," I pleaded. "You know that I've been reading a lot about mass murderers and serial killers, and I'm telling you, this guy has the look. These guys have some type of anger towards society. They just snap one day. They want to take out as many people as they can before they kill themselves." Now Jared was angry. I know I was scaring him. "Jason, he's a dork. He's not going to hurt anyone. He's just..." The lights dimmed and the previews came on. The longer I sat there, the more uneasy I felt. I could just sense that something wasn't quite right with this man. I had to do something. "Jared, come on," I demanded. "What?" he said, really irritated with me now. "Come on, we're leaving. I'm not taking a chance that we could be hurt by some wacko. There are so many of these guys around. They could be anywhere." I knew I wasn't making much sense. A part of me realized I was probably overreacting. But I'd been so immersed in the world of killers for so many weeks that now I saw danger everywhere. When verbal persuasion failed, I grabbed Jared by the arm and yanked him up from his seat. He started yelling at me to leave him alone. People stared. I noticed that even the weird man seemed embarrassed by the argument. Jared finally gave in and left with me. He was so mad at me that he refused to talk to me for several days afterward. I realized then how much these killers were getting to me. Whereas previously I'd been getting enough out of the protracted dialogues with Ramirez, Gacy, and Manson, and others to want them to continue indefinitely, now I felt an urgency to push things toward some sort of conclusion. If I didn't bring things to a close soon, there wouldn't be much of my mind left. Although Ramirez had been putting pressure on me, I decided to give it right back to him. I was tired of being coy. In my next letter to him, I asked what it was like to be in prison. I wondered how he dealt with all the everyday strains. I wanted the reassurance that no matter how much I was suffering, he had it far worse. "It's frustrating in here, for sure," Ramirez answered. "But even though I'm here, evil lives in the world, as it should." Then he signed the brief note, "Alive in the grave, R." From this point on, Ramirez and I continued to write back and forth. In each letter, I focused on a few questions I was curious about, all under the guise of being a devoted, concerned protege who wanted to understand his world. Inevitably, he'd comply with my request for information, but always in brief, enigmatic answers that had the word evil embedded in the message somewhere. Like any good behavioral psychologist, I rewarded him each time he cooperated by sending more photos of models who he believed were in my cult. He must have thought I'd discovered Lucifer's little black book, so numerous and gorgeous were the women I'd managed to conscript. Of all the letters I received from Ramirez, the one I found most fascinating was written on his own letterhead. On the top of the page, it proclaimed, "From the domain of the Night Stalker." In the body of the letter, he apologized for not having written in a while. "They took away all my stuff for 10 days. They accused me of some bullshit. Thanks for the great pictures. She's lovely. You are lucky. Morals, scruples, and all that other shit are just words to make people feel better about themselves. Enclosed is a flyer from a satanic group in Florida. Say hi to Jody for me." Jody was supposedly one of the girls in my cult, the most beautiful model of all from the photographs I had available. I told Ramirez she was completely in love with him and hoped to one day meet him in person. The rest of this letter was taken up with diligent answers to each of the questions I'd asked him. He really was being most cooperative. I first asked him about the type of power he felt when he was taking the life of an innocent woman with his bare hands. To my surprise, he answered very directly. "The power is indescribable, but it's there. As for now, I can only fantasize. That's why this lifestyle sucks. But out there, you can feel the draining of their energy, the total ecstasy. Get your mind into it. Savor it." He included many graphic drawings in his letters to me. Sometimes the pictures were satanic symbols or images of dismembered women. In one case, he sent me a self-portrait in which he appeared as a manifestation of the devil. One hand raised in defiance, middle finger extended, the numbers 666 etched on the palm. In another drawing he called Trophy Collection, there was a mantle with a female torso on top. The body was severed in half, with both arms amputated as well. Blood dripped from the body onto the mantle and then into space. Another drawing he did for me was titled Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. Across the top and side of the page are the words to a song. "I got pieces of April. Over here, over there," followed by musical notes surrounding the words. In the center of the page are pieces of a woman's body, a female head, torso, buttocks, leg, and arm, all severed and mutilated. Since things were heating up with Gacy, I decided to take a break from Ramirez for a while. in the same way I'd cut things off with Dahmer. My excuse for not being able to write for a while was that I was going to jail for beating my girlfriend. I felt that this was something he'd understand and appreciate. In spite of my resolution to set some limits on myself, I was surprised how hard it was to let go of Ramirez. He'd been the most cooperative of all my correspondents, willing to talk about almost anything I asked him about. Yet as much as I was learning from him, I was paying a price with my own sanity. There was no way I could keep juggling all these relationships at the same time. Gacy was the first person I contacted, and I'd already invested a great deal of time and energy in that relationship. Moreover, he was becoming more and more demanding of my time. I figured that once I stabilized things with him, I could return to Ramirez. In spite of this resolution, I found myself thinking again and again about the Night Stalker, about the opportunity he represented. Many times I thought about writing him again, but I'd restrain myself, remembering what happened the last time we'd been in close contact. Finally, my curiosity got the best of me, and I wrote him again after a month-long interlude. "Richard," I greeted him, "I'm back and ready for the Dark Lord. I was in jail because I beat the shit out of Tonya, but that will not slow me down in any way. The urge becomes stronger, and our followers are waiting. I want to keep the letters coming again. I want the teachings to continue." "Greetings," he wrote back cheerfully, as if our month-long hiatus was perfectly normal. "Thanks for the $10. It's been ages since I last heard from you. Say hi to Tia for me. So you were in the slammer. That's fucked. Did you ever get in touch with Order of the Evil Eye? Ever heard of Hand of Death? Thanks for the two pictures. That girl looks like she's really enjoying it. Seen any good movies lately? Send more pictures of girls with their butts in the air and back of their feet showing. To be sure I get them, send the pictures certified." He really liked the idea that I went to jail for beating my girlfriend. In fact, this appealed so much that he immediately wrote again to get more details. "What did you do to Tonya?" he asked. "Did you break her jaw? Did you stick needles in her feet and hands? Did you record her howls?" I found this very disturbing. Was he truly wondering what I did to her, or was he subtly suggesting things for me to do to her in the future? I later learned that he was actually telling me what he wanted me to do to her on his behalf. I was now his implement of destruction. He sent me the guiding motto of his life, urging me to follow this sacred truth. "Grant me the serenity for what I cannot change, the courage to change that which I can, and the wisdom to hide the bodies of people I kill." If I wasn't aware of the number and exact nature of the crimes he'd committed, I might think that he was pulling my leg. But this wasn't Ramirez's way of elbowing me in the ribs or winking at the mystique that had attached itself to him. He was serious. To learn more about the way he operated when he was in a killing mood, I went the indirect route once again, letting him know that I was planning on performing a sacrifice of my own in the near future. "What do you do right before you take the life of a victim?" I asked. "What goes on in your mind?" "First, you have to be calm," he advised me. "Then you savor the moment. You smell the aroma of the moment. The electricity. The blood. The beast." He closed the letter by warning me to be careful, to make sure I tidy up. By this, he meant that after I finished raping and killing my victim, I should cover my tracks and destroy any evidence that might link me to the crime. As I read this, I thought, what if I weren't a kid trying to learn from these killers? What if I were really a budding killer myself? Ramirez, Dahmer, Gacy, and Manson could supply me with all the motivation and ideas I'd ever need to carry through on a plan of total destruction. It occurred to me that there probably were people out there who were serious about carrying on the work of these deranged killers. If I could access this network so easily, why not them? It was an unsettling thought. Shortly after resuming my correspondence with Ramirez, I was again feeling that I'd gone beyond what I could handle. The cumulative months of receiving letters describing Manson's insane views on the world, Dahmer's attempts at seduction, Ramirez's satanic visions of murder, and Gacy's sadistic sexual fantasies pressed down on me like a coffin lid. With increasing desperation, a part of me groped for the sunlight, afraid that the old Jason might be irrecoverable. Chapter 27. The Experiment.
So, how was your weekend? Gacy asked during one of our usual Sunday morning chats.
These conversations had by now become almost routine. Fine, I answered. Didn't do much. Had a report to do for school, went out to eat with my family last night. By this time, I was almost relaxed when we talked. Usually, about 90% of our conversation was about ordinary stuff anyway.
Yeah?
Then, out of nowhere,
how's Jared doing? Did he play baseball this weekend?
The alarms started going off. He's fine, I guess, I answered testily. As a matter of fact, he's at practice now. Gacy always interpreted this sort of guarded response as jealousy on my part that he was directing so much attention my brother's way. I didn't bother to set him straight. So how is your weekend going? I said.
It's fine. I tried to catch up on some letters I hadn't finished. There are so many people writing me these days.
Was he saying I should be grateful? I wondered. Was this a threat to cooperate, or he'd cut me off? I thought about confronting him, but decided it was best to just play along.
Did you talk to Jared about anything?
Gacy asked in a tone that suggested he was winking on the other end of the line. No, I really haven't seen him much lately.
Well, he persisted, have you talked to him about the experiment we discussed?
Knowing that the only way to avoid this conversational direction was to hang up, I tried to be firm. No, John, I haven't.
Jason, he prodded, we've gone over this before. You need to slowly bring him into our way of thinking. You still haven't sent me any photographs of him.
I know, I apologized. I'm trying to get some. I'll see what I can do.
Don't worry, he joked. He's not going to replace you as my number one bitch. You know I like to be able to visualize who I am dealing with. I'm an artist, remember?
So irritated was I with having to keep up this charade that I said nothing. Gacy, of course, didn't slow down for a second.
And if you don't hurry with those pictures, he said with a laugh, I'm going to make you suck on my stick for a while.
After that remark, I ended the phone call immediately. I tried everything I could to change the subject, yet he still wouldn't drop the topic of my brother. It was apparent that if I wanted to maintain a relationship with Gacy, I'd have to make something up that would sound realistic enough to keep him happy. A few days later, I received a letter that contained a hypothetical scenario that was a thinly disguised blueprint for what he wanted me to act out with my brother. Every detail of this fantasy corresponded exactly to the layout of my house as I'd described it. As spooked as I was by how authentically he'd set the scene, I was actually grateful that, in a narrative sense, he provided me with enough of a start that I could follow his lead. Gacy's imaginary scenario between Jared and me went like this.
Late in the evening, around 11 o'clock, everyone had gone to their own rooms, since each had a TV. But we would tell the other to meet when the coast was clear. Both only dressed in a bathrobe, sometimes not even underwear, as the robe covers all. One went to the other room, and then they both descended the stairs down to the kitchen with no lights on, and went into the garage, where one would do the other. It would take 15 to 20 minutes or so, half hour if we both did something. And it's wild fucking standing up, as all one has to do is lean over the car while the other raises the robe, spits in the hand, and strokes the muscle, then another handful of spit to the backside, and in it went.
I put the letter aside for a moment, not only to purge the sickening image Gacy was creating, but also to quiet the eerie sensation that he'd invaded my house. The remaining pages read like what I imagine the blue boy equivalent of penthouse letters is. It was tough, real tough, to get through. Gacy projected that my brother and I would eventually have sex 3 or 4 times a day. His own sex drive was so strong that this was perfectly normal to him. Of course, not in 1,000 lifetimes would I even think, for an instant, of initiating anything like what Gacy proposed. But I had to feed the beast, as it were. So in my next letter, fiction at its most blatant, I let on that Jared and I had begun to experiment. Once Gacy read that, a barrage of questions followed. He used disguised terms and code words, referring to us, so that he could deny any responsibility or involvement if we ever got caught. His numerous queries actually provided me with the guidance I needed to create scenes that were sufficiently realistic and detailed.
"In your first encounter," Gacy wrote in his quirky, ambiguous language, "this took place with your being dominated by the other factor, and once the project was joined. What were your first feelings of what was happening? And, as it picked up and discharged within, what feeling did you have for a first time? Thoughts of who it was, and knowing this, what were your feelings too?"
When I tried to field these questions, I discovered to my horror that I had to actually visualize the events as he described them. Mentally, the cumulative effect was something like sexual abuse. He was actually making me think of the most horrid, revolting sexual scenes I could ever imagine. And, in fact, for several months afterward, I was totally asexual. I stopped having sexual fantasies and didn't think about sex whatsoever. This seemed to be the only way I could enter Gacy's world, or rather, allow him entrance into mine, without completely breaking down. One technique I came up with that actually yielded a fair amount of insight into Gacy's habits was sending him two sets of letters, one supposedly from me, the other supposedly from Jared, both describing the same acts of experimentation from differing points of view. To carry off the deception, I used different levels of diction and different typefaces. Result? Gacy actually believed he was getting the stereo version of a brother-to-brother sexual relationship. He started predictably, by writing to my brother in the most seductive way possible, feeding him graphic sexual fantasies in an attempt to bring him under his control. Of course, I intercepted all of Gacy's correspondence, whether it was addressed to my brother or me, so, thankfully, Jared never had to slog through Gacy's mental cesspool. At the time, as stressed as I was by the burden of keeping up this increasingly sick deception, I felt a certain excitement that my efforts had served to cement our relationship. After hearing about my brother's and my activity, he finally embraced me as his servant. He now believed I was completely under his control. And in a sense, I was. Chapter 28. Hook, Line, and Sinker. I often wondered why Gacy, one of the most cynical and suspicious individuals I've ever known, so easily believed the stories I spun for him. While I'd like to claim credit for being a master storyteller, the truth is that Gacy needed my tales to be true. At this point in his life, he had nothing else but his fantasies. The letters I was sending him were his only reality. Later, I learned from one of his acquaintances that he did in fact believe that everything I'd told him was on the level. As far as he was concerned, he'd stumbled across an ideal situation, one in which he could relive some of his most deviant desires. He was writing the script, and Jared and I were supposedly playing the parts. The one fly in the ointment was that his two leads were proving a bit difficult to direct. My character, in particular, kept balking at the idea of providing him with sufficient details of what we'd been up to. I realized that I'd made a mistake by giving him too much information too soon. Now, he was expecting kinky stories in every letter. Since I was supposedly the inhibited one, Jared's letters, or more precisely, the letters I'd concocted on his behalf, tended to be more vivid, and hence exciting to Gacy. But inevitably, I hit a wall of self-disgust as I offered up yet another dollop of titillation for Gacy's benefit, and at that point, I realized I had to change the focus of our correspondence. From that point forward, the tone of Jared's letters became dry and tedious, mostly consisting of tales in which he described encounters with his girlfriend rather than with me. I didn't anticipate how frustrated and angry Gacy would become. In his next letter, he railed at Jared for regressing to heterosexual activity and pleaded with me to bring my brother back into line.
Regarding Jay, I see his last letter was nothing again. Hey, if he is serious, then tell him to describe what he has been into or let me know when the best time to call where I can talk to him. But hey, he has to come out of his shell and tell me his thoughts and what he likes. But this BS about sex with his girlfriend, fuck that BS. That's for people who don't know better. He has got to know that I know all of his private instructions and I agree. But because you are not doing it all as often as you should, this is going to be a slow learning project.
After this initial scolding, Gacy sent along a typically graphic and detailed sexual fantasy that he wanted us to act out. The letter went on for pages, laying down a scenario that resembled some of his classic killings. He wanted Jared to sit on my chest. He described exact positions he wanted us to try. It was Gacy the porno writer at his most creative. I could only shake my head in wonderment. From my research, I knew that he enjoyed sitting on the chest of his victims, forcing them to perform oral sex from that position, often while he had a rope around their necks, tightening it according to his whims. Although he was a sadist, with young children he preferred to ruin their innocence first. Then, after they were dirty hustlers, he'd begin inflicting the pain they deserved. By late February and early March, Gacy had been denied access to Jared and his letters for several weeks. Finally, I sent another Jared letter just to calm him down. He responded immediately with this.
Hi-ho, bro. Or should that be Lil Bro? Ha ha. Yes, I know about your baseball as it's your first love next to sex. Please don't assume that I get mad at you as that's silly. Maybe Buddy says things too strong. And yes, I would appreciate it if when you read my letters that you get back to me in a reasonable amount of time. Of course, we could get over a lot of the letters by talking on the phone, but you denied me that twice. What you have to understand in talking to me is it's like talking to Buddy. We three share a common bond, and just like I have become Jason's big brother, he knows he can count on me not to laugh or make fun of what he tells me, nor am I ever judgmental of what he says. And that's the way you should feel as well, since I know just as much about you.
There were a couple of things that struck me immediately about this letter. First, it seemed clear he was trying to join my family, to become the older brother who'd guide and mentor us. Although in this particular letter, he posed as an equal to my brother and me, later he tried to exclude me from the bond we all shared. To him, this was necessary because Jared required more specialized tutoring in the art of sadistic seduction. Gacy realized by now that the character of Jared was a far more willing pupil than the more reticent and timid Jason. The second notable aspect of this letter was Gacy's apparent desire to train a successor to carry on his work. If I was a potential victim, perhaps the last one he'd get his hands on, then Jared was a potential surrogate who could act out the things he wanted to do. The rub was, he couldn't bring Jared fully under his control. When pleading and threatening didn't work with Jared, or rather the Jared character I'd created, Gacy tried bribing him. As mentioned previously, this was one of Gacy's favorite tactics when he ran into trouble, and he favored the move even after he was locked up. In this case, he promised Jared one of his paintings if he'd be more compliant. By this time, he'd already sent 2 paintings to me, which I kept in my safe. A third soon followed that was intended for Jared. It said something about Gacy's inflated opinion of himself, that he considered the gift of a simple drawing sufficient to turn an intractable student into a worshipful disciple. Chapter 29 Q&A. As a way to encourage Jared and me to supply more details regarding our supposedly ongoing sexual experimentation, Gacy sent along vivid descriptions of various escapades he'd had with hitchhikers over the years. Many of these boys he eventually tortured and murdered, although the versions he sent me featured a lot of consensual sex. Tucked into each of these tales was a lesson concerning how to break down a victim's resistance. The whole time Gacy was teaching Jared his tricks to dominate and abuse me, he was tutoring me as well, in the art of being a victim. In response to his insistent urgings, I'd begun reporting stories of hustling on the street, all, of course, spun out of whole cloth. He was very explicit in the acts he wanted me to perform, and what I should charge for these services. For example, for a golden shower, in which I was supposed to allow a man to urinate on my face, I should demand $50. He also advised that, during sadomasochistic sex, if the guy started to beat me up, I'd be better off if I just went along with it. I told Gacy I'd try some of this stuff. Yeah, right. But only if he'd agree to answer some questions he'd been putting off. I told him I was under a lot of pressure to finish a school paper I was doing on him, and that I really needed his cooperation. Drawing on a number of sources, including the fact sheet he'd sent with his very first letter, I peppered him with a long list of discrepancies between his original confession, his eventual testimony, and the later explanations he offered to account for the presence of so many bodies beneath his home. In 2 different letters, written to me during the middle of February, he took the time to address each of the questions. In his introductory remarks, he seemed quite put out that I'd even consider the possibility of his guilt. He portrayed me as obtuse and ill-informed, but decided to humor me anyway. His ability to deny the most overwhelming evidence against him is evident in what follows.
It is the totality of the facts on the fact sheet which gives doubt to my conviction, not just one thing. That's why it was done that way. That's why it is not me saying it, but 8 years of investigation proving all the points listed. Under our system of justice, a man is not guilty if the facts don't match the state theory of the crime or truth. That's why the doubt is listed, not with the major things, but all the things which point to showing that this was a poor investigation of the facts in this case.
In a masterpiece of flawed logic, he continues,
"The state said that I confessed to the crime, and that's not true. So the state is presenting improper evidence. They are giving you fantasy and not fact, which was told the trial jury. That could have led to believing my guilt and that was false.
In my letter, I'd asked him point blank about the manner in which he killed the boys. I've read and reread his response over and over again, and I have no idea what he is talking about. He maintains he was framed, that the prosecution lied to convict him because he was a convenient scapegoat, and that his confession was manufactured. He then goes on to list every discrepancy and unknown item related to his case. Supposedly, if you add up all these inconsistencies, they prove he was innocent. He cites, for instance, that the victims were killed in different ways, signaling different culprits. The police couldn't identify some of the bodies, nor could they say positively when the crimes were committed. There was a lot of drug and alcohol use going on in Gacy's house, engaged in by others, not him. The prosecution couldn't prove where he was at the time some of the crimes were committed. His main argument seems to be that nobody actually saw him commit the crimes, so he was within his rights to insist he didn't do them. When I read his long, convoluted arguments, all I could do was shake my head. Did he have any idea how crazy all this sounded? At his arrest, he said unequivocally, "I did it." Under interrogation, he revised his statement to say, "I didn't do it, Jack did," his alter ego. During psychiatric evaluation, he admitted, "I may have done it, but I don't remember." At his trial, he said, "Someone else did it and framed me." Later, he admitted to me, "They, the victims, deserved what they got." Did he really think that other people were so stupid that they'd forget all the things he'd said earlier and ignore the mountain of evidence? In a word, yes. He concluded his first mid-February letter with this point.
"If I were as guilty as the state would like you to believe, then how come there is so much to my appeal and I am not dead yet? Clearly, cases of crimes with death penalty conviction after mine are already dead within 6 to 8 years. Next month, we go into the 15-year. As there is a lot of doubt in my conviction, the May 10th date is not written in stone, and I wouldn't bet that I will die then."
Although I enjoyed drawing him out in this way, asking him direct questions just to see what kind of answers he'd give, he'd only let me get away with it on a few occasions. In his very next letter, he indulged me further by responding to each of the 53 questions I'd compiled from various magazines and books. In directing questions to him, I'd tried to focus in on areas he'd previously been evasive about. For instance, there was a long-standing story about his being caught when he was 5 years old smelling his mother's panties. Experts point to that as the earliest sign of his sexual deviance. I asked him to tell me about his panty fetish, whether he preferred clean or dirty ones, and what he did with them. He answered by saying that he used to take only the panties of his mother and keep them in a brown paper bag. He couldn't recall ever wearing or smelling them, and he said he eventually grew out of the habit. I asked him about his voluntary confession to the police, in which he not only admitted that he'd killed the boys, but actually drew a map showing where the bodies were buried in their exact positions. He insisted that there'd been an illegally obtained confession, and that the map must have been drawn by the police to frame him. I was feeling more and more frustrated by these programmed answers until I came to a question concerning his being sexually molested as a child. For a change, his answer was direct and to the point.
Yes, I was molested, by a contractor who would come take me for rides. I was 8 years old, and we always ended up with him holding my head between his legs. Until one day I was hiding when he came by, and Mom asked me why I didn't go. After explaining, she told my dad. Next time this guy came by, my dad yelled at him and he never came back again.
Gacy seemed to be in incredible denial about other issues, though. When I asked what it felt like to be beaten and abused by his dad, he vehemently denied that he felt anything but love for his father. He was equally insistent that all the other stories about him were false, that when he worked in a mortuary, he hadn't had sex with the bodies, and that he'd never raped anyone. It was my very last question to him, number 53, that he seemed to find most provocative. I asked why he tried to make a point to outsmart teenage boys. He responded like this.
I disagree about outsmarting boys, as they nowadays are streetwise. There you have the rest of your questions. You can learn all you want on the visit, as I will give you private lessons if you really want to know.
Now that was a frightening thought. Until this moment, the idea of visiting Gacy in prison sounded like a novel way to spend my spring break. It hadn't occurred to me that he might be planning something special for me. After all, I'd be safe behind glass partitions, and everything would be carefully monitored by guards and video cameras. How creative could he get? But there it was. The first clue that everything might not be as it seemed. Chapter 30. The Invitation. Every time I asked Gacy something he thought was too personal, private, or confidential to be discussed over the phone or via the mail, he'd say,
"When you come and visit, we'll discuss it then."
I just thought this was his way of avoiding having to answer. I also knew that I had neither the time nor the money to travel that far. In fact, in my whole life, I'd only been on one major trip out of the state. Additionally, there was the obvious problem of getting my parents, especially my mother, to agree to such a preposterous adventure. Many of my friends were planning trips during spring break to the beaches in Southern California and Mexico, or to the ski slopes in Utah. I could just imagine telling my mom, "Guess where I'm going over the holiday? Death Row!" At first, Gacy countered my reluctance by telling me I could hitchhike to Illinois, or even drive my own car. When, in a phone conversation with him one day, I balked at this suggestion, he said,
"Don't worry. Let me see what I can do."
I started to protest that I didn't have any money when he impatiently interrupted.
"Look, I'll talk to my attorney. I'll have him send you a check to cover the tickets and hotel. Even some spending money while you're here. How would that be?"
I was speechless. I'd now run out of excuses. I was also amazed that he wanted to see me so much he'd pay me to visit. "Wow, John, I can't believe it," I said, really meaning it. "I'm actually going to be able to visit you. This is going to be great. This is going to be awesome." Now, how was I ever going to get my parents to let me go? "Mom," I said excitedly not a minute later, "I just got off the phone with Gacy." I could barely catch my breath. He said I could visit him. He said he'd pay for the whole thing. Can you believe it? No, Jason, I can't believe it. Then she gave me her look that said I was being hopelessly naive. What does this guy expect from you? Nothing, Mom. He's in prison, locked up, with no normal people to talk to. I'm his way of connecting with the outside world. I'm his audience. I could see her smirking, but I tried to ignore her and explain myself. A difficult proposition, because even I wasn't sure why I needed to do this. Come on, Mom, I just want to know what makes him tick. And this could help someday when I try to get into graduate school. She rolled her eyes. It's the opportunity of a lifetime, I pleaded. How many people can say they interviewed a serial killer? That piqued her interest. Every mother likes to brag about her kids. She thought for a minute while I paced back and forth. Yeah, she agreed. It would be interesting, but I don't understand what a 50-year-old man has in common with an 18-year-old boy. People don't give anything for nothing, Jason. You know that better than anyone. She was referring to my constant suspiciousness. I was always assessing people's motives, and it was difficult for me to believe that anyone would do anything that wasn't self-serving. Looking back on it later, I'd find my making an exception of Gacy especially ironic. We get along great, I assured her. The guy is just lonely or something, and he appreciates the attention I give him. Besides, you know me. I can get along with people of any age. When I saw her nod her head in agreement, I knew I was scoring some points. Besides, I said, spreading the frosting on the cake, I could write some really cool papers for school about the prison system and serial killers. It's totally safe. It was the safety issue that most concerned my mother, as it would any parent. There was no way she was going to let me go unless she was totally convinced nothing bad could happen. She absolutely insisted on talking to the prison's warden to go over arrangements for the visit and hear his own assurances that I'd be protected. I agreed this was a sensible precaution. Frankly, I was amazed she was so amenable to the idea. I wasn't sure if she thought the whole thing was a scam by Gacy that would never come to pass. More likely, she saw, in me, a chance to vicariously live out her own fantasies of being a criminal investigator. After all those years of reading crime books, she realized how unique the opportunity actually was. Now that my mother was on board, I knew my father would be a snap. The only obstacle was setting up a conversation with the warden. The next time Gacy called, he was more than happy to speak with my mother, telling her that he and I would just hang out like old friends for a couple of days. He reassured her that he was just a regular guy. Sure, maybe he'd killed a few dozen boys my age here and there, but he could be charming when he wanted to be. Despite his breezy claims, my mother asked him straight out, "Look, you're on death row. What's to stop you from harming my son or making sexual advances toward him, or even killing him?" That seemed to give him something to ponder, because he waited a while before he responded. Finally, he said,
"First, I've never killed anyone. Second, if I did hurt your son in any way, they'd take away all my privileges."
He forgot to mention, however, that his scheduled execution date was just weeks away, and he really had very little left to lose. Still unconvinced, my mother said she'd have to talk to the warden, too.
"No problem," said Gacy. "It's already been arranged. Hold on."
While my mother was waiting to be connected to the warden's office, I told her that because Gacy was such a prison celebrity, there was even more than the usual amount of security to make sure nothing unpredictable would occur. Before she could answer, the warden came on the line.
"Hello, Mrs. Moss," he said. "How can I help you?"
"Well, Warden, my son was thinking about going down there to visit Gacy. How can I be sure that nothing bad will happen to him?"
"Well, you can never be completely sure about anything, Mrs. Moss, but we take a lot of safety precautions here at Menard."
"Will Gacy be able to touch Jason or be near him?"
"No, that won't be possible. They're each seated in two different rooms, with a glass wall between the inmate and visitor so they can speak to one another. Gacy will have his hands and legs shackled as well. There's also a camera in the room where the visitor is seated. This is monitored at all times."
"Really?" my mother said, apparently impressed.
"There's not much to worry about," said the warden. "There hasn't been an incident here in many, many years. Your son will be fine."
"Yes," my mother agreed. She seemed a bit flattered that someone with this much authority was treating her with such respect.
"Gacy gets visitors here all the time," he explained. "He's getting old, and, surprisingly, he can actually be fun sometimes. I don't think a guy trying to get out on appeal would risk his whole life and the postponement of his execution to try something stupid. And let me reassure you again, all he could do is try. The security is just too tight."
Before my mother hung up, she hit the warden with one last question. "What about guards? There'll be guards around, right?"
"Oh, yes. There'll be a guard walking the halls every couple of minutes, checking on Gacy and your son. If anything happens, all he'd have to do is holler, and a guard would be there in 5 seconds.
Thus reassured, she hung up the phone with a big smile, proud of how well she'd handled herself. She now realized that extraordinary security measures would be taken to make certain I'd be safe at all times. There was one tiny problem with the scenario. The warden, you see, wasn't really the warden. Gacy later admitted to me that he'd gotten one of the guards he'd befriended to pretend to be the warden, so my parents would feel reassured. To tell you the truth, I suspected something funny might be going on, but there was no way I was going to say anything and ruin this opportunity. Even if everything wasn't set up as Gacy's warden said it would be, I was confident I could handle a fat old man in handcuffs. None of us were really aware of the extent to which Gacy had a firm hold on the prison and its staff. He was a rich man by prison standards and could basically bribe anyone to do anything. He'd been living on death row for 15 years, much of that time spent in the company of prison guards he'd befriended. Thus, he was fully in control of his environment, more like a celebrated guest than a convicted murderer. And he had all the time in the world to plan exactly what he wanted to do to me.
Chapter 31. FBI.
"Federal Bureau of Investigation," the receptionist said in a voice that sounded like someone's grandmother.
"Hello," I said. "I was wondering if you had anyone in your office who deals with serial killers."
"Excuse me?"
"I'm a student at the university, and I'm going to visit John Wayne Gacy during my spring break. I was wondering if you had an agent who maybe dealt with these types of people."
In a hesitant voice, she said, "Please hold one moment." And then I got the dreaded elevator music treatment.
"This is Special Agent Reddy?"
I stumbled, a bit flustered now that I finally had a real FBI agent on the line.
Are you the person I should talk to about serial killers?
Excuse me, he said a bit patronizingly,
but what exactly are you looking for?
Well, I figured I had about 1 minute to establish my credibility or he'd hang up. I've been studying and researching John Wayne Gacy, the guy who buried all the boys under his house.
Yes, he said, obviously bored. I'm familiar with who he is.
This wasn't going well. I took a deep breath and just dived into the story. You see, I've corresponded with him over the last couple of months, and he's asked me to come and visit him. He thinks I'm this really stupid kid, and he tells me a lot of stuff about his crimes and things. He promised me if I came to visit him, he'd tell me a lot more, things he's never told anyone. I'm not sure what...
Okay, hold on a second, he interrupted. Let's slow down a little. I need your name and address, your date of birth, and social security number. I meekly gave him the information. I knew what he was doing. He was looking me up in the computer, probably checking to see if I was a known troublemaker. When he got back on the phone, he seemed a little nicer. He asked me to tell him the story again, more slowly this time. He asked a lot of detailed questions about how I'd managed to strike up a relationship with Gacy and what I was after. Once I gained his trust, we had a good conversation. He even told me about his younger daughter, who also went to the university. I want you to call Special Agent Welcher in the Chicago field office. I'll call her first to let her know who you are and that you'll be contacting her. She's the agent who deals with Gacy out there, and she's probably the best person to help out with this. I'd urge you to make contact with her before you visit the prison. After waiting half a day for Reddy to give Welcher a heads up, I called the Chicago field office and spoke to her. She was most cooperative and friendly, eager to hear my tale. She asked me all the questions I'd grown used to, why I'd contacted Gacy and other serial killers, what I was going to do with the information, and whether my parents approved of what I was doing. Apparently, I answered correctly, because she gave me the lowdown on what to expect. Jason, she concluded, I'd like to debrief you after your visit and find out what you learned. Would you please call me from your hotel room or when you return home? If you need anything at all, or if something happens, feel free to call the office and we'll assist you. Thanks, I replied, genuinely grateful she'd taken me seriously.
I really don't think he's going to give you much. I've been talking to him for years. He loves to play mind games. He'll try to control the conversation the whole time you talk with him.
Yeah, I agreed. I sure know that.
Well, obviously, if he wants to tell you about any of the murders or others we're not yet aware of, I'd like to know about it. He talks and corresponds with a lot of pedophiles, some of whom we're actively doing investigations on. Any names or lists of these people would be helpful as well.
Okay, I'll try.
One more thing, she said. He keeps a folder containing information on all his victims. See if you can get a look inside. We think it might include details we don't have. I assured her I'd do my best. She then wished me luck and told me to be careful. He's still a very dangerous man, she warned. I hung up the phone, feeling validated. It finally seemed like the worthiness of what I was doing had been recognized. I realized, of course, that these agents were humoring me to a certain extent. After all, the chances of my learning anything of value were remote. Still, officials of the country's top law enforcement organization had heard me out, and had even been encouraging. For that, I was grateful.
Chapter 32. Journey.
I'd never traveled much, and this was to be one of the first out-of-town trips I'd make alone. My destination aside, I was pretty nervous at the thought of flying someplace all by myself. I was scheduled to leave on a red-eye flight to St. Louis, arriving very early in the morning. Gacy's lawyer was going to meet me at the airport and then drive me the 90 miles to the prison. The plan was for me to spend 3 days in the local town, visiting Gacy each day for several hours. It was a lot of time with him, but I figured I'd need several visits to get the information I was looking for. Despite our 3-month correspondence and all the phone conversations, I knew it would take a while to win his trust. I spent the final day at home organizing myself for the trip. It was one of those early spring days when the desert winds were blowing. Dust and sand were everywhere. You couldn't even breathe the abrasive air without sneezing. So I was forced to stay in most of the afternoon and endure my mother's fussing. "Don't forget your toothbrush," she nagged. "And it'll probably be cold in Illinois, so bring your red sweater." "Sure, Mom," I said, exasperated. We'd been through this 3 times.
"Do you have enough money?"
"Yes, I have plenty."
"I'll have Dad give you some more anyway. Do you need your flashlight?"
"My flashlight?" I groaned. "Give me a break. I'm not going on a camp out. I'm staying at a motel. Gacy set up everything." She ignored me. I could tell she was really worried.
"Do you have some books to read? Don't forget to bring gum for the flight."
Finally, to escape her nagging and to vent my own nervous energy, I braved the winds and went shopping with my brother. Walking through the mall, he and I joked about my destination. That I was embarking on this trip during spring break seemed particularly incongruous. Jared couldn't get over my chutzpah. "I think it's funny watching Mom and Dad try to stop you from doing all the crazy shit you do," he said. "I love to watch their faces when you ask permission for things. It just cracks me up when you tell them you want to talk to them about something." I just smiled. It felt good to have my brother on my side. He seemed to understand how I thought, and he didn't judge me the way others did. Talking to him about my plans seemed like a perfect way to spend the afternoon. Finally, though, the long day drew to a close. Everyone in the house was irritable and nervous, and I went upstairs one more time to make sure I had everything I might need to prepare myself for Gacy. This included a notebook that contained all the details of the stories I'd told him. I'd carefully logged the exact outfits I was wearing when I was supposedly prostituting myself on the streets, as well as the exact times, places, and scenarios of the encounters I told him I'd had with Jared. I also decided to bring a notepad so I could debrief myself each day upon returning from the prison. I planned to take detailed notes on everything that had occurred, so I could recreate it all for the honors thesis I was already planning for my senior year. In addition to the notes, pad, 3 days' worth of clothes, and a camera, I also brought along a book called The Psychopathic Mind. I was hoping to get some last-minute insights on how to handle myself during the visit. Walking out the front door of my house that evening, I saw the worried look on my mother's face and felt a tinge of sadness. I realized how much stress I put on my family, and how apprehensive they were concerning this latest stunt. I was feeling pretty nervous myself, but there was no way I was going to show it. A second chance like this wouldn't come along. Chapter 33. The Attorney.
It was still dark outside at 5 o'clock in the morning when my flight arrived in St. Louis. I could smell dampness in the air. Smiling, I thought about how in elementary school we'd all run outside when it would rain because it was such a contrast to the monotonous dry heat of the Mojave Desert. It seemed amazing that there were places like St. Louis where the air was thick and humid. At the gate, I waited nervously for my ride. I saw several men standing around, looking like they were meeting people, so I tried to make eye contact. Gacy's attorney had a picture of me, but I had no idea what he looked like. It was about 10 minutes, but it seemed much longer, before a man in a ski jacket and running shoes approached, his hair disheveled like he'd just woken up. I was very confused, because Gacy had said his lawyer was tall and thin and would be wearing a suit. This guy was short and overweight. "Are you Jason?" he said with a shy smile. He seemed younger than I expected for someone who was an expert on appellate law. Actually, he didn't look like a lawyer at all, but rather like a relative of Gacy's. He bore a striking similarity to John, with the same jowly face and body shape. They even had the same balding pattern. In a flash, I put two and two together, sizing this guy up as not Gacy's lawyer, but a relative Gacy had sometimes referred to, who apparently functioned as a kind of all-purpose assistant. "Yeah," I answered. "And you're Ken." Ken extended his hand, which I shook tentatively. He seemed confused as well, because I was much bigger than he expected. Not at all what he imagined a meek 18-year-old kid would look like. He was a chain smoker, and he seemed nervous. I wondered why. I was the one who should be anxious, especially since Gacy had lied about sending his attorney. Still, he seemed friendly enough, eager to please and accommodate me any way he could. I was relieved by his cooperation because I was going to be dependent on him for transportation during the next several days. I was too young to rent a car, so the only way I could get to and from the prison was with him as an escort. We walked out to the parking lot where he had a rental car waiting that Gacy had paid for. The sky was just beginning to lighten to a dark gray. Once again, I noted the smell of rain in the air. I kept taking deep breaths so I could remember what it felt like. During the hour drive into the town where I'd be staying, I watched the scenery flash by. It was so different from anything I'd ever seen. Everything was so green and lush. We passed farms and little stores and grazing land. There were cows everywhere. I'd never seen so many cows in my life. Then it started to drizzle. I managed to keep the conversation on Ken during most of the trip. I was trying to find out who exactly he was and what his relationship was to Gacy. From what I could determine, he was Gacy's Guy Friday, someone who worked as a gopher running errands for the attorneys. Occasionally, he said, he even handled some of the legal chores himself. He visited Gacy on a regular basis, bringing him supplies, books, and magazines, and messages. It struck me as quite a strange relationship. Gacy later told me he didn't trust Ken much. He was just using him for his money and time. As for Ken's devotion, the family tie seemed to be the least of it. Mostly, Ken enjoyed hanging around with someone he considered a celebrity.
"Everyone wants a piece of me," Gacy later told me, "and Ken is no different. He just likes to be around me so he can tell people he's my friend.
I think it was Ken's docility and passivity that really earned Gacy's disapproval. I, on the other hand, appreciated those qualities in him. As you can imagine, I was quite apprehensive regarding what Gacy might really have in store for me. It was obvious, though, that Ken wouldn't be a threat. In fact, I quite liked him. That is, until we started to check into the motel. "That will be one room, please," he said. "Two beds." "No, Ken," I objected a little too loudly. "We need to get two rooms." "Jason," he said, almost whining, "John said for us to get one room. He was definite about that." Then, as an afterthought, he said, "It's just to save money, if you know what I mean." Yes, I knew exactly what he meant. Or thought I did. My theory was that Gacy believed I was so poor I wouldn't have any choice but to stay in whatever accommodations he'd arranged. He'd set things up so that Ken and I would be sleeping in the same room, knowing I couldn't object. Gacy had told his relative about my supposed sexual proclivities and what a handsome fellow I was. It seemed reasonable to conclude that Gacy's plan was to make a gift of me and get back detailed reports that would enable him to experience vicariously what was beyond his grasp. "I'm sorry, Ken," I said, acting as if I really was disappointed, "but one of my parents' conditions for my going on this trip was that I stay in my own room. They said they'd pay for it." Well, the first statement was true anyway. As for the latter, I'd be the one paying. Ken seemed quite dismayed. "You know," he pressed, "it sure would be a lot easier if we used the same room. That's the way John wanted it." Then he shrugged, as if to say, "Well, if you want to disappoint him." "Look, Ken, it's no big deal, but my parents would feel better if we did it this way." With that, I turned. "See you in a little while for breakfast." As I watched him walk to his own room, I considered whether I should dump him and try to arrange my own visits to the prison. He seemed harmless enough, though, and I was grateful for the companionship. I felt very alone in this strange place. The town of Chester, Illinois, was very small and quiet, like something out of an old movie. Coming from the hustle and bustle of Las Vegas, I found its tranquility and beauty appealing. All the houses looked as if they'd been built in the 1920s. The bank, the movie theater, the stores, they all looked like antiques. Apparently, the town's most famous former citizen had been the creator of Popeye, the cartoon character. There were statues honoring the guy all over the place, and once a year the town organized a Popeye celebration. Chester was actually built around Menard Correctional Center, the town's largest employer. Most of the guards and their families lived there. Strangers were relatively rare. "Whenever people come to town looking different," the girl at the front desk of the motel explained, "we usually assume they're coming to visit an inmate. You're probably here to see one of the big ones like Gacy." Ken and I ate breakfast at a little diner. It was so quaint I wanted to take out my camera and shoot pictures. There was a group of older men sitting at a table, drinking coffee and talking. They kept looking at us, no doubt guessing at our relationship and which prisoner we were going to see. "Don't worry," Ken tried to reassure me. "They're staring because you're so young. For entertainment in the mornings, they all sit there and talk about the visitors. Just ignore them." During breakfast, he told me what to expect going into Death Row for the first time. He said I should leave all of my jewelry in the motel room because it wasn't allowed, and that I should try not to wear anything with metal on it, including jeans with zippers, because the metal would make the machine go off. This has been so stressful on the family, he said, abruptly changing the subject. Having a relative on death row isn't easy. It takes a toll on all of us. Yeah, I can imagine it's tough on you at times. You don't know the half of it, Jason. I mean, John isn't exactly easy to get along with. He's always asking me to do stuff, and he gets kind of moody at times. I felt sorry for the guy. He seemed to have devoted his whole life to taking care of Gacy, a man who had no respect for him and showed little appreciation for his efforts. We finished our breakfast under the careful scrutiny of the old men and then headed for the prison. Finally, I'd have some answers to my questions, though not the ones I was prepared to ask. Chapter 34. Long Walk. From a distance, the prison looked like a medieval castle. Built in 1878, Menard Correctional Center is the largest maximum security facility in the state of Illinois. It houses mostly long-term prisoners serving sentences of 20 years or more. But it also counts among its residents those inmates who are considered especially violent and uncooperative. As we approached the gates, I spied one very large red brick building that I later learned housed the general population. The building looked quite old. Massive fences surrounded the entire facility, fanning outward in layers. About 20 fortified guard towers added to the feeling of impregnability. "There it is," Ken said as he pointed to a building in the distance. "That's where they keep the most dangerous ones." I strained my neck to catch a glimpse of Death Row over the barbed wire fence. All I could see was the edge of a quite ordinary-looking building, as old and worn as all the rest. The building that houses Death Row sits high on a hill overlooking the Mississippi River as it winds its way through Illinois on its way to the Gulf of Mexico. Although the state doesn't actually execute people at this facility, it does keep them in storage here until they're called elsewhere. "Well, time for you to go," Ken said in his usual cheerful voice. Bless his heart, though. He could tell how nervous I was. "So, you'll be coming to get me when?" I asked. I wanted to make sure I had all the details clear in my head. He took me through the plan for the fourth time. Everything would be taken care of. All I had to do now was walk through the gate. I approached the entrance slowly, shifting my gaze from left to right as if I were afraid someone was about to pounce. A guard buzzed me through and then proceeded to X-ray me. He removed all my personal possessions and gave me a bunch of forms to sign. In essence, the paperwork absolved the prison of responsibility for anything that might happen. "Two forms of identification, please," the guard said, eyeballing me as if I'd just committed murder myself. I handed him my driver's license and social security card. "Why do you guys need all this information?" I asked, genuinely curious. "Do you get a lot of visitors here?" The man just sat silently behind the counter, writing down all the information that appeared on my IDs. "Not one for small talk," I concluded. "Have you been to prison before?" he finally asked in a bored voice. "No, this is my first time. I said brightly. I added, I'm doing a project for school. I wanted him to know that I wasn't related to any of the inmates. He looked down from his perch. There are a few things that I need to tell you before you go inside. I nodded and remained at attention. In the unlikely event hostages are taken inside the prison, we won't negotiate for your release. If something happens in there, if there's a riot or an escape attempt, we won't give an inmate as much as a pack of cigarettes for your release. If we did, then the prisoners would do it all the time, thinking they could get privileges or even their freedom. I couldn't believe he was telling me this. Even if it was true, why did he have to tell me in such a cold way? So you're saying that if someone takes me hostage, you'd let them kill me before you did anything to save me? Yeah, exactly, the guard said with a smirk. At another checkpoint, a guard directed me to place all my belongings except for a watch and $25 in a locker. As I was cleared to enter, I heard another guard say on a walkie-talkie, "Get Gacy. He's got a visitor." At those words, my heart started racing. I looked back one last time, then entered a room furnished with vending machines. This area looked like an elementary school cafeteria, but not nearly as nice. Blinding white cinder blocks rose up on four sides. Above, a seepage stain smeared the ceiling with yellow. The air smelled of old coffee and burned-out cigarettes. I'd been passed along to another guard who escorted me inside. Leon was a small guy and really ugly. In addition to his slight build and acne-pitted, unshaven face, he displayed a short scar on his right cheek. "Mind if I ask you some questions?" I asked. "I'm doing a project on the prison system for school."
"Sure. What do you want to know?"
"Do you feel safe here working with all these convicts? I mean, aren't you worried you might get attacked?"
"Not really. If you treat them right, they'll treat you good too. If you treat them like shit, then you gotta expect trouble back."
"Like what?" I asked. "Can you give me an example of what happened to a guard who got attacked?" He hesitated a second, perhaps considering how much of a raconteur he wanted to be.
"Well, there's this guard who we call Leaky. We call him that now because he was dragged into a cell and stabbed 18 times in the chest and stomach with a pencil."
"No shit," I said. I wish I'd kept my mouth shut. I was just trying to keep the guy talking so I didn't have to think about where I was going.
"Yeah, he just got on this power kick, but he's a different man now."
"You mean he's still alive?"
"Oh yeah," Leon said with relish, enjoying the effect this story was having on me. "He still works here."
"Don't you think that's just a little crazy, to be still working here? I mean, is it worth dying for your job?"
"Nah," Leon said. "I would have left. I'm gonna be out of here anyway. I'm taking the test soon to become a regular police officer. Leaky has nowhere else to go. He's got a family, and I guess he's kind of trapped. He sure is a lot more laid back now."
Leon pointed to the vending machines and explained that I'd need to load up on food for the day. Although even the thought of food made me sick, I put in some money and got a microwavable hamburger.
"Are you sure that's all you want? It can be a long day, and you might get hungry later."
"I don't have much of an appetite."
"Okay, then," he said. "Now stay close behind me."
He and I walked into an empty, windowless chamber. Once inside this steel cage, all conversation stopped. In fact, Nobody I came in contact with during this long walk said a single word to me. As we made our way through the winding corridors, I could hear the constant clattering of prisoners yelling and talking to one another. Some hallways echoed with the blast of radios. Others were completely silent. Even more noticeable than the noise was the musty smell. The whole place reeked of mildew and sweat. The only prisons I'd ever seen before were in movies, and they didn't look like this. Despite Menard's worn facade, I'd entered this building expecting a clean and modern interior. But this was more like a dungeon. The stairwells were dimly lit and spooky. The walls and floors were dirty. And the air, it felt old and stale, like it had been recirculating for 50 years, retaining all the dust and dampness. I kept stifling the urge to sneeze. Leon left me in another waiting room until he could go around to the other side and open the gate to Death Row. If I felt self-conscious before, now I felt utterly transparent. Down the corridor, handheld mirrors poked through cell bars and tilted to capture an image of me. After what seemed like an eternity, Leon finally let me through the gate, where I was asked to sign in one more time. As I gripped the pen, I noticed my hand was shaking. As I entered the long corridor, I was nearly sick with apprehension. My heart was thumping so hard in my chest I couldn't catch my breath. I steadied myself, trying to keep my balance. In less than a minute, I was going to meet John Wayne Gacy. And suddenly, the irony dawned on me. Despite exchanging hundreds of letters with him, despite speaking with him on the phone several times a week, I realized I didn't really know him. Until a person visited this place and saw what Gacy had been forced to put up with every day for 15 years, they couldn't really know who he was or what he might be capable of. I was about to find out. I gathered myself together, took a shallow breath, the best I could manage at the time, and forced myself to look straight ahead toward the barred door and the person who was waiting beyond it. Gacy stood quietly and patiently as I approached. I noticed with alarm that his only restraint was a pair of loose handcuffs, fitted on him by a guard who stood by. When I drew even with the door, the guard opened it for me, and I stepped inside. He then stepped through to where I'd been, locked the door, and began to walk away.
Excuse me, I said, close to panic. Surely he wasn't just going to leave me here alone. Excuse me, guard!
The guard turned around to look at me through the bars. I could make out a thin smile.
I was just wondering where you were going, I said.
This was nothing like I'd been led to expect. He just looked at me, shook his head, and continued to walk away.
Guard, I yelled to his back. Where will you be if I need you?
Maybe he didn't hear me, I thought, as I watched him round the corner. I couldn't believe I was being left alone with a man who'd killed 33 boys my age. Just as I thought about calling out one more time, I noticed Gacy watching me with an amused smile. God, this was humiliating. I was utterly speechless. I couldn't have yelled for help, even if I'd wanted to. My heart was now hammering so hard my chest ached. I could feel little droplets of sweat running down my back. At that moment, as terrified as I felt, incredibly, I also experienced a certain thrill. I'd done it. I'd come face to face with a genuine monster. Believing this meeting was the end product of my careful planning, not Gacy's, I told myself I was still in control. Some of my confidence came back. I can do this, I thought. I can do this. Chapter 35. Face to Face. I was utterly alone in the visiting area, except for Gacy standing motionless in front of me, eerily still. Looking at the guy, you'd hardly think he was capable of such brutal violence. He appeared to be a short, fat, aging, jolly fellow, sort of like the slightly weird uncle you tolerate because he means well. He stood about 5 feet, 8 inches tall, and was extremely overweight. His face was chubby, with skin so pale and soft it appeared translucent. His hair was carefully combed and styled with some sort of thick oil. He seemed ordinary in every sense, a harmless man who wouldn't hurt a fly. Without saying a word, he extended his handcuffed wrists to shake my hand. God, I'm about to touch him. As repulsed as I was, I also felt exhilarated. I put out my sweaty hand to greet his. Rather than look directly at my face, he smiled as he held my hand and looked down at my crotch. That small gesture was enough for me to consider pulling away my hand and running for my life.
"Nice to see you," he said, as he continued holding on to my hand.
I could feel his index finger gently caress the inside of my wrist. As I opened my mouth to say something, he turned and began walking away. After looking back furtively at the locked door, I fell into step behind him. The visiting area consisted of one large room sealed off from the guards by steel bars. A small walkway led from there to several smaller rooms designed for privacy. Some rooms were furnished with a table and chairs. Others were so tiny there was space for only 2 chairs. One larger room was designed for an inmate to speak through a partition to visitors on the other side. I wondered why Gacy and I weren't meeting in the partitioned room, as I'd been told to expect. There was even a video camera there to monitor everything. Before I could ask, Gacy gestured towards me impatiently.
"Come on, Jason," he prodded. "This way."
Then he led me to the end of the hall, farthest away from the corridor where the guards were supposedly stationed. He seemed to have arranged the room according to his exact specifications. The space was tiny, even claustrophobic, and he'd placed 2 chairs side by side, so it would be impossible for me to put myself beyond his grasp. The only other furnishings in the room were a radiator and a piece of wood that looked like it could function as a desktop if we both balanced it on our knees. Gacy's logbook, the one the FBI agent had wanted me to gain access to, lay on the floor. Actually, it wasn't a book, per se, but a massive red file folder labeled top-secret case files. I'd shortly learn what its contents included. Autopsy results for each victim, a copy of all Gacy's appeals to the Supreme Court, and full documentation supporting Gacy's theory that he'd been framed for the 33 murders. As I took the seat Gacy offered me, I noticed that directly across from our room was a small janitorial room that smelled of cleaning supplies. I could see a mop in there, some rusty chains, a bucket, and a chair. The chair was the only item that looked as if it hadn't been there for 100 years. In fact, it appeared to have been deliberately placed there. As I finished getting my bearings, the other thing I couldn't help but notice was that we were seated out of the range of the video camera that was supposed to monitor our conversations.
"How did the guards treat you?" Gacy asked as he took the seat next to me. "Were they okay?"
"Yeah, they were fine," I answered.
"I saw out the window," Gacy said. "It looks like it might be a nice day out today. Probably not as nice as Vegas, though, huh?"
I tried to muster some enthusiasm for this conversation about the weather, but I was still trying to figure out why the security camera wasn't pointed our way. It looked like it might have been deliberately readjusted. This whole scene was incredible. Whereas I'd expected security to be incredibly tight for my visit, I was now confronted with the reality that I'd be completely on my own. There was no glass partition separating us. There were no guards standing around monitoring the conversation. For some reason, they'd immediately run off, as if they were giving Gacy privacy to do whatever he liked. In fact, as it would become clear, that's exactly what they were doing. Over the many years Gacy had spent in the guards' company, he'd convinced them he was a model prisoner. Further, as a man of financial means, he was in a position to do them favors. Throughout the time I was in Menard, I noticed how close Gacy seemed to be with the guards. He had nicknames for them. He exchanged jokes with them. At one point, he didn't like what they'd brought him for lunch, so he just sent it back and asked for something else. Incredibly, the guards scurried off to fetch his requested meal, as if they were waiters at a 4-star restaurant. Somehow, Gacy had arranged for us to be completely alone during our talk. I assume he told the guards he had a piece of ass coming to take care of him. Would they mind terribly if they made themselves scarce for a few hours? He'd make it worth their while. Since he'd never caused them any trouble in the previous 12 years of his residence, they had no reason to mistrust him. Besides, the poor guy was scheduled to die in a few weeks. What was the harm of letting him have a last fling? Gacy seemed thoroughly pleased with the way things were turning out. Not only were we out of view and the guards out of range, but there was nobody else in the waiting area. The reality was that I was alone in a locked, unmonitored room with a psychopath who'd raped, tortured, and strangled many boys just like me. Making my situation even more frightening were Gacy's mutterings.
"This is perfect," he'd say, or, "I can't believe this."
I said a silent thank you for the cuffs he was wearing, albeit loosely. Without them, he'd surely be rubbing his hands together like some mad scientist about to throw the switch on a fiendish experiment. The more nervous I felt, the more Gacy seemed at ease. We chatted for a while about the most ordinary things, which I thought was just bizarre. Here I was, an 18-year-old kid, talking with a convicted murderer about hotels being built in Las Vegas, the most recent sporting events, and what the drive was like from the airport. He seemed especially interested in how I'd gotten along with Ken, and the comfort level of the motel I was staying at. I knew he was fishing for details about whether Ken and I had become best buddies. After an hour or so, I'd forgotten that I was with John Wayne Gacy, the famed clown killer. Against my will, I began trusting this man sitting across from me, even appreciate his charm and wit. Calming me further was the structure Gacy imposed on our interactions. In a bid to impress me, he showed me a couple of letters sent him by different news outlets, including Inside Edition, asking him for interviews. The unstated message was, "Look how privileged you are to have quality time with me." In fact, he'd set aside 3 days for us to be together, although I had no idea what we'd do with all those hours. After showing me the letters, he got up out of his chair and looked around the corner, presumably to see where the guard was. When he did this, I acted like I hadn't noticed. I just continued to stare at the words on the page, wondering what the hell was going to happen next. I didn't know whether to lead or follow, but figured that since the role I was playing was that of a passive, potential victim, I'd act as helpless as I could. Believe me, it wasn't difficult.